Chapter 6. When Jason Steele woke up, the biggest, meanest-looking black man he'd ever seen was standing at the foot of his bed, looking down on him.
"How you feeling, kid?"
said Ice. "Better," Jason said, a bit nervously, through swollen lips. "Who are you?"
"Friend of your daddy's. Name's Ice."
Are you a cop?" Ice smiled.
"Not hardly."
He sat down on the edge of the bed.
"Feel up to talking much?"
"Yeah, I guess so. Where's my father?"
"He'll be back as soon as he can. Meanwhile, we gotta see what we can do about finding your little sister. You remember that man who that worked you over?"
"Yeah," said Jason bitterly. "I remember him real well."
"What'd he look like?"
"Tall, slim, about 6'4" or so, but he was wearing real high heels," Jason said. "Boots, but the kind of girl would wear, you know. Dark skin, but not black. Hispanic, I think. Maybe Italian. Young guy in his 20s. Real long black hair with silver streaks in it. Long black leather trench coat, tight pants, ruffled shirt, a lot of chains and rings. I remember the rings especially," he said, touching his battered face. "Weird eyes. Scary looking." Ice grimaced.
"Want you should take a look at something," he said.
He picked up one of the mug books that the police sent over and flipped through the pages.
"This him?"
He showed Jason the photograph. "Yeah, that's him! That's the guy!" Raven stuck her head through the door.
"He awake?"
"Yeah,"
said Ice, shutting the book and putting it down.
"You feel like eating something, Jason?"
she said.
"How about some soup? You need to get your strength up."
"Some soup would be nice. Thank you, Miss Scarpetti."
"Just call me Raven, hon. We don't have to be so formal. I'll go put some on for you."
"I'll be back later,"
Ice said.
"Take it slow."
He followed Raven out into the kitchen.
"How's he doing?"
she asked.
"He'd be okay,"
said Ice.
"He tell you anything about the creep that did it?"
"Yeah,"
said Ice.
"I know who it is."
She glanced at him sharply.
"Who?"
"Your old friend, Rico."
Her eyes went wide.
"Jesus, are you sure?"
"Kid ID'd his mugshot. I think I go pay the man a call,"
said Ice.
"I'm going with you."
"Not a good idea,"
Ice said.
"Besides, someone gotta stay here with the boy."
"I'd like to tear his eyes out with my bare hands,"
Raven said savagely.
"The things that bastard put me through, the things he made me do."
She took a deep breath.
"When I think of Steele's daughter being with him."
She clenched her fists.
"Maintain, girl,"
Ice said.
"I bring her back, don't worry."
"Hurt him for me, Ice,"
Raven said through gritted teeth.
"Kill the son of a bitch."
"Count on it,"
said Ice. He turned and went out the door. That poor kid, Raven thought. She knew just how it must have happened. She got picked up by one of Rico's talent scouts, a kindly-looking, well-dressed older man with a soft voice and good manners, anxious over a young girl who seemed to be in trouble. She could imagine how Corey Steele must have felt when she realized, too late, the terrible mistake that she had made. Hey there, back again. This is going to be a real bad couple of paragraphs here. Just be forewarned. Rico would have raped her, brutally. He always did, to break down their defenses, just as he had done with her. After that first time, he never touched his girls again, except to punish them or keep them in line. But that first time was something that would stay with Corey for the rest of her life. She'd never be the same again. Rico was a real twist. Her hands trembled as she made the soup for Jason. She remembered her own introduction to the life. She had been Tommy Borodini's girl, living at the Enclave out in Cold Spring Harbor. Very young, not quite 16. Tommy had seemed glamorous. He was good-looking, fun to be with, rich. He'd taken her out in high style, and she thought she was in love. Until the day she caught Tommy in bed with one of her best friends. They'd fought, and Tommy had struck her repeatedly. She had laid his face open with a knife, and that had sealed her fate. He'd beaten her bloodily. Then turned her over to his thugs. Those animals had gone at her for hours, until she thought she'd lose her mind. And all the time, Tommy had sat there, watching. Yet that was not the end of it. The worst was still to come. They threw her in a car and drove her to the city, out to no man's land. They had given her to Rico as a present, on Tommy Borodini's orders. By the time Rico was through indoctrinating her, She had no resistance left, but in time she started to defy him, and even Rico finally decided she was more trouble than she was worth. She thought he'd kick her out, but she had underestimated his cruelty. He had turned her over to the Skulls. They took her to that warehouse where Victor Bordini stored his weapons and his drugs. Steele came with Ice to bust the place and found her being gang-raped by the Skulls. He'd rescued her, and she'd been with him ever since. At first, only to help him get Tommy Bordini, and later, after Tommy B was dead, because she didn't ever want to be with anyone else. She didn't think of him as being a cyborg, part man and part machine. We're just going to transition over to this, I guess. It didn't matter to her that he had a cybernetic brain. The only thing that mattered to her was that Steele was the first man she'd ever met who treated her as if she were a person, a human being with some worth. He didn't care about what she had been, what she had done, or what had been done to her. And it hadn't taken very long at all for her to fall in love with him. Earlier that day, an officer had come back to pick up Steele's battle mods. Now that he was out there somewhere, hunting another cyborg like himself, a man who had once been his partner and best friend, while his son lay bruised and battered, and his daughter was in the hands of a psychopathic pimp whose savage cruelty Raven knew all too well. What must he be feeling? Okay. How would he be able to do what he had to do with all that on his mind? She was afraid for him, and she was afraid for Corey. She poured the soup into a bowl, and trying to compose herself, took it to Jason. She found him out of bed, halfway dressed.
"What do you think you're doing?"
she said, putting the soup down on the nightstand. "I'm gonna go look for Corey," he said.
"Like hell you are,"
she said.
"Get back in bed."
Don't try to stop me," he said. I appreciate what you're doing, but..."
"But nothing,"
she said, taking him by the shoulders and pushing him gently but firmly back down in the bed.
"You're not going anywhere. You're going to stay right here and rest. The doctor said you shouldn't move much till you get some x-rays, and I'm going to make damn sure you stay put. I promised your father I'd look after you. Ice went to look for Corey. Don't worry, he'll find her and bring her back."
"He said my father had to go out on a job."
"That's right. Something real important came up."
"More important than finding his own daughter," Jason said.
"Don't be that way. Your father had no choice. It tore his heart out to leave while Corey was still out there somewhere and in trouble. But there's a maniac out there who's killing people, and your father is the only one who can stop him."
"Why?"
"Because the killer is another cyborg. Only something went wrong in his brain, and he's out of control. Your father's got to find him before he kills any more people. Ice knows where Corey is. He's going to get her. He'll bring her back, and he'll make that bastard pay for what he's done."
Jason was silent for a moment. "Who is he?" he said finally. "Is Ice his real name?"
"I don't know his real name,"
said Raven. She sat down in the bed beside him.
"I don't think anybody does. He used to be the leader of a street gang called the Skulls."
"The Skulls?" said Jason, surprised. "But they're criminals!"
"He isn't with them anymore,"
said Raven.
"He's working with your father now, for the government."
Jason shook his head. "So much has changed," he said. "I'm still confused." He moistened his lips. "My mother told us Dad was dead."
"I know,"
said Raven.
"For what it's worth, Jason, I think she meant well. She just didn't understand."
"I'm not sure I do," Jason said. "I heard about him on the news. That's how Corey and I found out he was still alive. But I really don't know what to think. I mean, he looks and acts the same, but they say his brain is a computer now."
"That's right,"
said Raven.
"That doesn't make him a machine. At least, not as far as I'm concerned. He's still your father, Jason."
"What happened to him?"
"He was shot up real bad by Victor Bordini's men. When they brought him to the hospital, he was in a coma. There was nothing they could do for him, but the man he works for, a CIA man named Higgins, had him brought to a lab in the federal building. Your father was doing some work for the government, a secret project. They put a special chip into his brain as part of an experiment to see if people could link up with computers. After he was shot, they used that chip to take all the information from his brain, what they call mental engrams, and put it into a cybernetic brain that they replaced his real one with. I know it sounds pretty wild, but he's not a machine, Jason. He's just got some artificial parts, that's all. Prosthetics, like anybody who's been in an accident or who's handicapped. But your mother didn't see it that way. Because one of those parts is a computer brain, she thought they turned him into some kind of robot. It scared her. I guess she just did what she thought was best. Here, eat some of this before it gets cold."
Jason started to eat gingerly. "You love him, don't you?" he said. Raven nodded.
Yes, I love him very much,
she said. How did you meet him? She hesitated.
It's a long story,
she said.
You know, you should call your mother, let her know you're here. She's worried about you.
You spoke to my mother?
She came looking here for you and Corey, but your father told her to go back home and wait, just in case the two of you came back.
I'm not going back, he said bitterly. She lied to us. She told us Dad was dead. She told us the truth. None of this would have happened.
People make mistakes, Jason,
she said.
I know I've made my share, but I'm not saying your mother was doing the right thing, what she did. But she still loves you, and she's worried sick about you.
I don't want to talk to her, Jason said. What happened to Corey is all her fault. I'll never forgive her for that.
I can understand your anger,
Raven said.
But you can't blame what happened to Corey on your mother. It's not her fault. It's the fault of that bastard, Rico.
He glanced up at her sharply. Rico, you know his name? Raven sighed.
Yeah, I know his name,
she said. She hesitated.
He used to be my pimp.
Jason stared at her. Your pimp? You mean you're a... He stopped, flustered and embarrassed.
A hooker,
she said.
At least, that's what I was before I met your father. It's part of a long story I told you about. I didn't choose to be a prostitute. I got trapped into it, a lot like Corey did, so I know exactly what she's going through right now. And it's pretty rough, believe me. We'll get her back, but she's going to need a lot of help and understanding. She's going to need you to be there for her. She's going to feel dirty and ashamed. She might need to see a doctor for a while to help her get through this. And she'll need her family behind her, giving her love and support. She'll need you and your mother to be there for her, to be strong and be together.
After what Mom did, I doubt she'll want to go back, said Jason.
She'll want to go back,
said Raven.
She'll need to go back. And we'll have to make sure your mother understands what Corey's been through. It won't be easy. Believe me, knowing what that will be punishment enough for her. Nobody should have to go through something like this. Nobody. Don't hate your mother. This whole thing is going to bring her more pain than anyone deserves. Try to forgive her, Jason. Because for your sake and for Corey's, you're going to have to help her to forgive herself.
Jason looked at her and smiled. I can see why my dad likes you, he said. You're a pretty special lady. She smiled and kissed him on the cheek.
You're pretty special yourself, hun. If I had a brother, I want him to be just like you. Now, why don't you call your mom and let her know you're safe?
Okay, he said. But I'm going to wait until Ice comes back with Corey. You sure he can find her and bring her back? That Rico's pretty mean.
Not half as mean as Ice,
said Raven.
He'll bring her back. Don't worry. Now, why don't you get back to bed and try to get some rest? If you need anything, just yell. I'll be right outside.
By the time they arrived, it was all over. One of the choppers had spotted flames coming from the windows of the building and radioed one of the squads to investigate. It could have been merely another fire. It happened frequently in No Man's Land, with people building fires in the abandoned derelict buildings in order to keep warm. The flames hadn't much chance to spread, and the first squad on the scene managed to extinguish them with their portable firefighting gear. They called in to tell other squads in the task force what they found. The other units rapidly converged upon the building. Steel stepped onto the charred and smoking apartment on the third floor. At some point, the walls had been knocked down so that it was just a large room, opening out into the adjoining apartments on either side. The place was a wreck. Not that it must have looked much like much to begin with. There was rubble on the scarred wooden floor, and the walls, where they weren't scorched, were covered with Chinese gang graffiti. A partially burnt flag with a green dragon on it, and some Chinese characters hung limply on the wall. There was a makeshift bar and some battered old furniture scattered about. Some of it had burned. There were several crates placed around the walls. Most of them had either been opened or broken into. One large open crate was packed full of cocaine, which the dragons had been rendering into crack. There were several metal garbage cans placed around the apartment in which fires had been built. Two of them had been knocked over, which had helped to start the fire, but it wasn't the only cause. There were bullet holes in the walls and in the battered furniture, and the walls were fire-scarred and cratered with what could have only been plasma blasts. There was blood, a lot of blood, spattered on the walls and furniture and ceiling, pooled and coagulating on the floor. Volkirk turned towards Steele, his face pale and drawn. He looked ill. Jesus Christ, he said. Look at them. Steele looked, and his stomach churned. Their bodies had been hideously mutilated. The stench was awful. Huge chunks of them had been missing. Entire limbs chopped off, flesh cut from the bones as if they had been butchered, Steele said. Why? Asked Volkirk. One of the other officers was doubled over against one of the walls, puking his guts out. My God, why would he do this? I don't think he did, said Steele. Then who? Tunnel dwellers, Steele said grimly. I've seen this sort of thing before. They didn't want to burden themselves with the bodies. They just cut off the parts they wanted. Sweet Jesus, Volkirk said. Got to get some air. They went outside. One of the officers approached them. Lieutenant, we found a survivor in the alley, he said. Looks like he jumped from one of the windows. His legs were broken. He dragged himself into a pile of garbage. We would have missed him if he hadn't called out to us. I want to see him, Steele said. They went back out into the street. The paramedics already had the surviving gang member on a stretcher and were about to load him into a waiting van. Wait, said Steele. He came up to the stretcher and looked down at the dragon. It was just a kid, Jason's age, maybe even younger. They all looked so tough and mean in their gang colors and their chains, with their studded bracelets and bandanas and their guns. But he didn't look so tough now. He just looked broken. They'd given him something for the pain, but he was still conscious. Can you talk? Said Steele. Yeah, said the kid dully. What happened? Hell happened, man. He just came busting in, shooting, eyes glowing with red lights. Him and those goddamn tunnel freaks, lousy motherfucking cannibals. Never even had a chance. I went through a window, broke my legs. Lucky. Others all got wasted. How many of them were there? I don't know, man. Dozen? Maybe more. Derelicts. Tunnel freaks. And that red-eyed bastard. Fucker wasn't even human. What did they get out of those crates? Asked Steele. AKs? Vipers? Some M14s and other stuff. Grenades. Grenades, said Steele. Great! Just great! He glanced at the paramedics. Okay, go ahead. Wait, said the kid. You're Steele, aren't you? That's right. You know me. Saw you on the news. You're just like him. The fucking red-eyed freak. He's just another one like you, ain't he? The corner of Steele's mouth twitched. Yeah, he's another one like me. Go on. Get him out of here. They load the kid into the van. Don't let it get to you, Lieutenant, Volkirk said. Stalker's not like you at all. Steele's jaw muscles tense. Oh, yes, he is, Volkirk. Yes, he is. The three goons approached him as Ice came into the lobby of the building, his long black leather coat thrown over his shoulders like a cloak. Where do you think you're going? One of them said. He drew back the bolt on his assault rifle. Ice brought up his hand from beneath the coat and fired his big .44 Magnum semi-auto, shooting the goon right through the chest. As he flew backward, Ice quickly brought the gun around and shot the other one. The top of his head came apart in a spray of blood and bone. Ice snapped off a third shot, shooting the legs right out from under the third hired gun. Before he could bring up his weapon, the man went down, his rifle clattering to the lobby floor. He lay writhing on the ground, clutching his shattered kneecap, gasping and crying out with pain. It had all taken no more than about 2 seconds. Ice walked up to him and looked down at the writhing thug. No, Jesus! No, no, don't! I stepped on his knee. The scream tore through the lobby.
Where's Rico?
Ah! No! Please! Ice bore down again. The man screamed with agony.
Where?
Ah! God! God! Top floor! 12A! Please! I need a doctor!
No, you don't,
said Ice. He raised his gun and shot the man through the head. Though the building was just over the border inside no man's land, it still had power. Rico and the other residents could afford to pay their bills. Ice got into the elevator and punched the button for the 12th floor. As the elevator started to ascend, he glanced up and saw a security camera aimed down at him. He raised his gun and shot it. As the elevator reached the 12th floor, Ice stepped to the front and flattened himself against the wall beside the sliding door. The elevator stopped and the door slid open. Immediately, an automatic rifle opened up, spraying the inside of the elevator. The instant the firing stopped, Ice stuck his arm around the door and fired. The shot took the man in the chest as he was trying to slap in a fresh magazine and hurled him back against the corridor wall. He slid down to the floor, leaving a smear of blood on the wall behind him. Ice quickly glanced up and down the hall and stepped out of the elevator, holding his gun ready. He bent down and quickly picked up the dead man's automatic rifle, an Uzi 9mm carbine. He picked up the fresh magazine and slapped it in, then drew back the bolt. He hugged the wall as he moved down the corridor, heading towards Suite 12A. Everything was quiet. No one stuck out their heads outside the doors. In this neighborhood, they knew better. He reached the door of 12A, kicked it in, then quickly stepped back out of the way. Three shots came through the open door. He crouched down low, stuck the barrel of the Uzi around the doorframe near the floor, and fired a short burst. He heard a cry and the sound of a body falling to the floor. He straightened up and took a quick, cautious glance inside. A man lay on the floor, gasping with pain and clutching at his bullet-ridden shins. The gun was on the floor beside him. He looked up, saw Ice, and started to reach for the gun. Ice aimed the Uzi down at him.
Don't even think about it.
he said. The man was breathing short sobs. His legs were bleeding badly.
There's Rico.
The man's mouth opened and closed spasmodically. He was in agony, starting to go into shock. I stood over him and aimed the Uzi right between his eyes.
I asked you one more time,
he said. Ugh!
He's not here!
Where's Corey Steele?
Ah, Jesus!
Where?
She went with Rico. Christ!
Where'd they go?
I don't know. I swear to God. I swear!
Ice decided the man was telling the truth. He bent down and picked up the man's gun, then patted him down quickly. Aside from a knife, he was carrying no other weapons. He quickly searched the apartment. One of the doors was locked from the inside. He stepped back and gave it a kick. It flew open. Several girls screamed. There were four of them, dressed in flimsy nighties. Or filmy nighties, as this says. And lace lingerie, huddled together on the bed, clutching each other fearfully.
Doris, please! We'll do anything you want!
I'm looking for Corey Steele.
Corey? She's not here!
I know that. Where?
She went with Rico, one of the girls said. He made a call, then took her with him.
Who'd he call?
Somebody named Ricky B.
Ice frowned.
Rick Borodini?
He said.
Yeah, that's right. He called him Mr. Borodini.
Damn!
Said Ice through his gritted teeth.
Please, don't hurt us. We'll do anything.
Where'd he take her?
We don't know, mister. Honest, I swear to God.
Shit,
said Ice.
Stay here,
he told the girls. He went back out into the main room. The man on the floor was unconscious. He'd lost a lot of blood. Ice went over to the phone and picked it up, keeping his eye on the door. He quickly punched in the number. When the call was answered, he said,
This is Ice. Let me talk to Hardesty.
He waited several minutes until the Strike Force chief's surly voice came on the phone.
Hardesty,
he said.
I got a line on Corey Steele,
Ice said.
Pimp name of Rico had her in his stable.
Where are you?
Ice gave Hardesty the address.
You better send some people down here. There'd be some bodies to clean up.
I figured that,
said Hardesty dryly.
Did you find Corey?
No,
said Ice.
Girls here say Rico took her to see Rick Borodini.
Christ,
said Hardesty.
They'll use her to get back at Steele. You know where Borodini is?
No, but Rico called him from this place. I figure I'd give you the number here. Maybe you can find out where the call went.
I'll get right on it. What's the number?
Ice gave it to him.
Okay, I've got it. Where are you going to be?
I wait here until your people show up, in case Rico gets back first. Then I'd be back at Steele's place. I figure Rick be getting in touch. Call me there.
Right! Can you describe the pimp?
Puerto Rican,
Ice said.
Real pretty. Long black hair with silver streaks. Tall, slim, wears high heels, fancy clothes, and lots of jewelry. Drives an old white Lincoln. You ought to have him on file. Last name's Calvary.
Okay, said Hardesty. I'll have a couple units out there right away, and I'll put out a bulletin on the car. And Ice, if this guy gets back before they get there, try not to kill him.
Best tell your boys to hurry up then,
Ice said. He hung up the phone and went over to the bedroom door. The hookers were still huddling together on the bed, terrified.
I'd be down in the lobby,
he said.
If Rico call, you make like nothing wrong and come down and tell me. You do just like I say, or I'd be real upset.
Sure thing, mister. Anything you say.
He turned to leave.
Hey, mister!
He turned back.
You gonna kill him?
Yeah.
Good,
she said. The white Lincoln pulled up in front of the old warehouse near the waterfront, just off Canal Street. Rico's driver, a knife-scarred, beefy former member of the Skulls, blew three short blasts on the horn and the door opened to admit them. Men armed with automatic weapons quickly surrounded the car, and as Rico got out, they started searching it. Rick Borodini wasn't taking any chances. He had armed guards posted outside and on the roof as well. The place wasn't nearly as well fortified as the enclave in Cold Spring Harbor, but since the feds had raided it with Steele's help, the Borodini crime family had fallen on hard times. Borodini's oldest son, Tommy, was dead, shot by his own brother, Rico Heard. Tommy B. had put the snatch on some government officials and was holding them for ransom, but the plan went sour when Steele hit the enclave and captured the old man. The feds had offered to cut a deal to swap Victor and Polly Borodini and their other prisoners for the hostages that Tommy and Rick had taken, but word was that Tommy didn't want a deal. He'd waited to waste the hostages and take the all operation for himself, right off his father and his brother. So Rick had shot him and cut the deal with the feds. So far as Rico was concerned, it was no great loss. He had known Tommy Bordini well. He was part of Tommy's operation, and he had provided some special entertainment for him on a number of occasions. He'd never liked Tommy B, but he could understand him. Rick Bordini, he didn't understand at all. Rick scared him. Tommy had been crazy, but Rick was totally controlled. He never showed a flicker of emotion. He was the coldest man that Rico had ever met. The loss of the Enclave had been a serious blow to Victor Bordini, but he was a long way from being finished. Though the Delanos picked up a lot of his action, he still had people who were loyal to him and still had powerful connections. He had a lot of money salted away and maintained good relations with the Chingos and the Skulls. He still had politicians in his pocket who didn't dare turn on him for fear of being exposed, and he was determined to put his operation back together. And Rico knew that when he got back on top, as he had no doubt that Bordini would, he'd remember those who helped him on the way. And this, figured Rico as he pushed Corey ahead of him, was one fine present to be bringing to the man. They were escorted through the warehouse towards some offices in the back. One of their escorts knocked on the door, then opened it to admit them. There were several rough-looking men inside the dingy office. At the desk, Polly Bordini sat behind a small computer, entering data. The desk was piled high with paperwork. The slight, youthful, girlish-looking Polly looked out of place in this environment, with his long hair and delicate features. He didn't even look up as Rick entered. He was intent upon his work. Polly, Rico knew, was the brains behind the Bordini operation, the one who kept the books and carefully monitored all transactions. He was a marked contrast to his brother, Rick, who looked like a male model, fit and darkly handsome, always dressed in exquisitely tailored suits. The two brothers could not have been more unlike. The fragile Polly had an innocent, childlike quality about him. Rick was hard and feral. He exuded deadly menace, like a barracuda. "I brought you a present," Rico said with an evil grin. Polly looked up briefly, then went back to his work. Rick came around the desk and stood in front of Corey. He lifted her chin up gently and looked into her eyes. "So this is Steele's daughter," he said softly.
"Would you believe it?" Rico said. "She just fell into my lap. A runaway, picked up by one of my people. Until today, I didn't even know who her daddy was. Where's Mr. B?"
"My father," Rick said, still looking at the girl. "You didn't think he would be here, did you?"
"Well, I don't know. I figured."
"Don't figure," Rick snapped. "My father is somewhere safe until we can establish a new and more permanent base of operations." He smiled at Corey. "And I think this young lady is going to help us do that. You can go," he said to Rico. Rico hesitated. "Was there something else?" said Rick.
"Well, I'm going to lose money on this girl," said Rico.
"You'll be taken care of," Rick said. "Polly, give the man 5 large out of petty cash." Polly reached into one of the desk drawers and removed the cash box. He took out $500 and handed it to Rick. Rick stuffed the money into Rico's inside coat pocket.
"Thanks, Mr. V," said Rico,
disappointed that it wasn't more, but he figured he had bought some goodwill as well. "Show him out," said Rick. As Rico walked out, Rick turned to one of the men seated in the office and nodded to him. The man got up and followed Rico out. Rico was escorted back to his car. As the warehouse door was opened, the driver started up the Lincoln. Rico lit up a cigarette. $500 wasn't all that bad, he thought. She'd have brought in much more than that in a couple of days once he'd had her broken in right, but it was better than nothing. Besides, there were always more where she came from. He rolled down the window and stared with disbelief at the silenced barrel of the 9mm semi-automatic pointed at his face. The gun coughed twice. Rico slumped over in the seat. The gunman holstered his weapon, then opened the car door and retrieved the $500 bills from Rico's inside coat pocket. He turned and spoke to the driver. "Take the car out and dump it somewhere," he said. The man nodded without a word. He turned on the radio and slowly backed the Lincoln out through the doors. They closed behind him. End of chapter.